They came to the Momu track through the forest near Sengisengi in the late afternoon and lay up at the forest edge until it was dark. Then they crossed the open ground in the night. Seppu led Daniel to the logging road, where he had abandoned the Land Rover almost 10 days previously. But even Seppu could not lead him directly to the stranded vehicle. It was only the following day that they at last found the Land Rover, exactly as Daniel had left it behind its screen of dense undergrowth, sunk to its axles in the soft forest floor. There were no fresh human tracks around it, and the video equipment was still in its aluminium carrying cases. Daniel laid it out on the tailboard of the vehicle and checked it quickly. The camera was not working. Either the batteries were flat after standing so long, or else the moisture had penetrated the mechanism. Daniel noticed droplets behind the glass of the lens, and condensation beaded the casing. It was a bitter disappointment. But Daniel could only hope that the batteries could still be recharged, or that a rudimentary cleaning and drying once he had reached Gondala would get the camera serviceable again. He gave Seppu the case of cassettes to carry, while he took for himself the camera, the lens, and the spare battery packs, a burden of almost 70 pounds to lug through the steaming forest. Heavily laden as he was, the return took almost twice as long as the outward march, and it rained most of the time. As soon as he reached Gondala, Daniel recruited Victor Omeru's assistance. He knew that Victor was a qualified electrical engineer. Victor had built and installed a turbine generator beneath the waterfall at the head of the Gondala glade. It generated 220 volts and almost 10 kilowatts of power, sufficient to supply the community with lighting and to operate Kelly's laboratory equipment. So Victor was able to place the battery packs for the video on charge and found only one of them was defective. The camera and the lens were a different problem altogether, however. Daniel would not have known where to begin to look for the fault, but Victor stripped the camera and cleaned the condensed moisture. He checked the circuits and found one of the transistors was blown. He replaced it with one of them that he cannibalized from Kelly's gas spectroscope. Within 24 hours, he had the VTR functioning again. Then he took down the lenses and cleaned and dried them out and reassembled them. Daniel realized just what a difficult task the old man had undertaken in such primitive conditions. "If you ever get your country back, I've always got a job for you, sir," he told Victor. "That's not such a good idea," Kelly warned him. "You'd probably end up working for him." "All right," Daniel said. "I've got a camera. Now, what do you want me to film?"
"We leave tomorrow morning at first light," Kelly told him.
"I am coming along, Kelly," Victor Omeru told her.
"Well, I don't think that'd be very wise, Victor." She looked dubious. "You're much too valuable.
After all my hard work, I deserve a little reward, don't you think?"
He turned to Daniel. "Besides which, you might have another breakdown in the equipment. Come on, Dr. Armstrong. Put in a good word for me."
"Chauvinists, both of you," Kelly protested. "You're ganging up on me just because I am a female. I'll have to call Pumba to my aid."
"Hell no," Daniel shook his head. "That's using too much gun." But he shared Kelly's misgivings. Victor Omeru was over 70 years of age, and the going would be tough. It was almost 50 miles to Wengu. He was about to say so when Victor intervened quietly.
"Seriously, Ubomo is my country. I cannot rely on second-hand reports. I have to see for myself what Tafari is doing to my people and my land."
Neither of them could argue with that. And when the safari started out from Gondala the following morning, Victor Omeru was with them. Seppu had recruited 8 men from his clan to act as porters, and Pumba appointed herself as caravan manager to make certain that they applied themselves and did not lose interest in the typical Bambuti fashion, dropping their bundles to wander off fishing or honey-hunting. Every man in the clan stood in awe of Pumba's tongue. On the third day, they reached the first of the bleeding rivers, and the Bambuti men lowered their loads to the ground and huddled on the bank. There was no laughter nor banter. Even Pumba was silent and subdued. Daniel climbed down into the stinking morass of red mud, dead animals and poisoned vegetation, and scooped a handful of it. He sniffed it and then threw it from him and tried to wipe the filth from his hands.
"What is it, Kelly?"
He looked up at her on the bank above him.
"Well, what caused this?"
"It's the reagent that Tafari swore to you that he would never use. She was dressed only in a cotton T-shirt and shorts with a coloured headband around her brow, and her small, neat body seemed to quiver with outrage. "Victor and I have been monitoring the effluent from the mining operation. At first it was pure mud. That was bad enough. Then recently, in the last few weeks, there's been a change. They've begun using a reagent. You see, the platinum molecules are coated with sulfides. The sulfides reduce the efficiency of the recovery process by 40%. They are using a reagent to dissolve the sulfide coating and to free the platinum."
"What does the reagent consist of?" Daniel demanded.
"Arsenic." She spat the word like an angry cat. "They are using a 2% solution of white arsenic to break down the sulfide coating."
He stared at her in disbelief. "But that's crazy."
"You said it," Kelly agreed. "These aren't sane or responsible people. They are poisoning the forest in a murderous orgy of greed." He climbed up out of the dead river and stood beside her. Slowly, he felt her outrage seep into his own conscience. "The bastards," he whispered. It was as though she realized the moment of his total commitment to her cause, for she reached out and took his hand. It was not a gentle or an affectionate gesture. Her grip was fierce and compelling. "You haven't seen it all yet. This is just the beginning. The real horror lies ahead at Wengu." She shook his arm demandingly. "Come on," she ordered. "Come and look at it. I challenge you to remain on the sidelines after you've seen it." The little column moved on, but after another 5 hours' march, the Bambuti porters abruptly halted and dropped their packs and whispered together.
"Now what is the trouble?" Victor wanted to know, and Kelly explained.
"We've reached the boundary of the clan hunting area," she pointed ahead. "From here onwards we will be entering the sacred heartland of the Bambuti. They are deeply troubled and perplexed. So far only Sepu has seen what is happening at Wengu. The others are reluctant to go on. They are afraid of the wrath of the forest god, the mother and father of the forest. They understand that a terrible sacrilege has been committed, and they are terrified."
"Oh, what can we do to persuade them?" Daniel asked. But Kelly shook her head.
"We must keep out of it. It is clan business. We must leave it to Pumba to convince them." The old lady was at her best now. She spoke to them, sometimes haranguing them shrilly, at others dropping her voice to a dove-like cooing and taking one of their faces in her cupped hands to whisper into an ear. She sang a little hymn to the forest and smeared ointment on each of their bare chests to absolve them. Then she performed a solitary dance, shuffling and leaping as she circled. Her withered breasts bounced against her belly, and her skirt of bark cloth flipped up at the back to expose her surprisingly neat and glossy little buttocks as she cavorted. After an hour, one of the porters suddenly picked up his load and started along the path. The others, grinning sheepishly, followed his example, and the safari went forward into the sacred heartland. They heard the machines at dawn the next morning, and as they went on, the sound became louder. The rivers they crossed were waist-deep and thick as honey, with the fearful red-poisoned mud. Apart from the distant growl and roar of the machines, the forest was silent. They saw no birds or monkeys or antelope, and the Bambuti was silent also. They kept close together and they were afraid, darting anxious glances into the forest around them as they scurried forward. At noon, Sepu halted the column and conferred with Kelly in a whisper. He pointed towards the east, and Kelly nodded and beckoned Daniel and Victor to her.
"Sepu says we are very close now. Sounds in the forest are very deceptive.
The machines are working not more than a few miles ahead. We dare not approach closer, for there are company guards at the forest edge."
"What are you going to do?" Victor asked.
"Sepu says there's a line of hills to the east. From there we'll be able to overlook the mining and logging area. Pumba will stay here with the porters. Just the four of us, Sepu and I, you, Daniel and Victor, will go up into the hills." Daniel unpacked the VTR and he and Victor checked it. "Come on," Kelly ordered, "before the light goes or it begins to rain again." They climbed the hills in Indian file, with Sepu leading. However, even when they came out on the top, they were still hemmed in by forest. The great trees soared high overhead, and the undergrowth pressed in closely about them, limiting visibility to 20 or 30 feet. They could hear the bellow of diesels below them, closer and clearer than before.
"Oh, what now?" Daniel wanted to know. "Can't see a damned thing from here."
"Sepu will give us a grandstand view," Kelly promised. And almost as she said it, they reached the base of a tree that was a giant amongst a forest of great trees. 20 pygmies holding hands can't encircle this tree, Kelly murmured. We've tried it. It's the sacred honey tree of the tribe. She pointed at the primitive ladder that scaled the massive trunk. The pygmies had driven wooden pegs into the smooth bark to reach the lowest branches, and from there they had strung liana ropes and lashed wooden steps that ascended until they passed out of sight into the forest galleries 100 feet above where they stood. This is a Bambuti temple, Kelly explained. Up there in the high branches, they pray and leave offerings to the forest god. Seppu went first, for he was the lightest, and some of the pegs and steps were rotten. He cut new ones and hammered them into place with the hilt of his machete, and then signalled the others to follow him. Kelly went next, and reached down to give Victor a hand when he faltered. Daniel came last, carrying the VTR slung over his shoulder, and reaching up to place Victor's feet on the ladder rungs when he could not find them for himself. It was slow progress, but they helped the old man up and reached the upper gallery of the forest safely. This was like the land at the top of Jack's beanstalk, an aerial platform formed by interlinked branches and fallen debris. New plants had taken root in the suspended leaf mould and trash and formed a marvellous hanging garden where strange and beautiful flowers bloomed and a whole new spectrum of life flourished closer to the sun. Daniel saw butterflies with wings spread as wide as his hands and flying insects that sparkled like emeralds and princely rubies. There were even lilies and wild gardenias growing in this fairyland. Daniel caught the flash of a bird so jewelled and splendid that he doubted his own eyes as it vanished like a puff of brilliant smoke amongst the foliage. Seppu barely allowed them to rest before he began to climb again. The trunk of the tree was half as thick at this level, but still as huge as its neighbours had been at their bases. As they went higher, so the light changed. It was like coming up from the depths of the ocean. The green submarine glow brightened until abruptly they burst out into the sunlight and exclaimed with wonder. They were on the top branches of the sacred honey tree. They looked down upon the carpet of the forest roof. It spread away, undulating like the billows of the ocean, green and unbroken on every side, except in the north. All their eyes turned in that direction, and their cries of wonder faded, and they stared in horror and disbelief. In the north, the forest was gone. From the base of the green hill below them, as far as they could see to the north, to the very foothills of the snow-clad mountains, the forest had been erased. A red plain of desolation lay where once the tall trees had stood. None of them could speak or move. They clung to their lofty perch and stared speechlessly, turning their heads slowly from side to side to encompass the enormity of the bare, devastated expanse. The earth seemed to have been raked by the claws of some rapacious beast, for it had been scoured by the torrential rainwaters. The topsoils had been torn away, leaving stark canyons of erosion. The fine red mud had been washed down to clog and choke the rivers through the forest. It was a desolate lunar landscape. "Merciful God," Victor Omeru was the first to speak. "It is an abomination. How much land has he defiled? What is the full extent of this destruction?" "Well, it's impossible to calculate," Kelly whispered. Even though she had seen it before, she was still stunned by the horror of it. "Half a million? 1 million acres? I don't know. But remember, they've been at work here for less than a year. Think of the destruction in another year from now. If those monsters," she pointed at the line of Momu vehicles that was strung along the edge of the forest at the foot of the hill, "if those monsters are allowed to continue..." It was an effort for Daniel to drag his eyes from the wide vista of destruction and to concentrate on the line of yellow machines. From their high vantage point, they seemed as tiny and innocuous as a small boy's toys left in the sandbox. The Momu were in a staggered formation, like a line of combine harvesters reaping one of those endless wheat fields on the Canadian prairie. They were moving so slowly that they appeared to be standing still. "How many?" Daniel asked, and counted them aloud. 8, 9, 10, he exclaimed. Running side by side, that gives them a cut line almost 400 yards wide. It doesn't seem possible that just 10 machines have been able to inflict such terrible damage. Victor's voice shook uncertainly. They are like giant locusts, remorseless, insensate, terrible. The caterpillar tractors were working ahead of the line of Momus, scything the forest to make way for the monstrous earth-eating machines to follow. Even as they watched, one of the tall trees quivered and swayed. Then it began to move, swinging ponderously as the steel blades ate through the base of its trunk. Even at this distance, they heard the scream of living timber rending. It sounded like the death throes of a wounded animal. The falling tree gathered momentum. Its death cry rose higher and shriller until the trunk thudded into the red earth and the mass of foliage shivered, then lay still. Daniel had to look away. Seppu was perched beside him on a high branch, and he was weeping. The tears ran very slowly down his wrinkled old cheeks and dripped unheeded onto his naked chest. It was a terrible, intimate grief, too painful for Daniel to watch. He looked back just in time to see another tree fall and die, and then another. He unslung the VTR from his shoulder and lifted it to his eyes, focused the telephoto lens, and began to film. He filmed the devastated bare red plain, on which not a living thing remained, not an animal or bird or a green leaf. He filmed the line of yellow machines grinding inexorably forward, keeping their formation rigidly, attended by an endless horde of container trucks, like worker ants behind the queen ant, carrying away the succession of eggs she laid. He filmed the red poison spewing from the dump chutes at the rear of the Momu, falling carelessly upon the savaged earth, where the next rainstorm would carry it away and spread it into every stream and creek for 100 miles down the contour. He filmed the fall of the trees ahead of the line of yellow machines and the giant mechanical saws mounted on specially modified caterpillar tractors. Fountains of wet white sawdust flew high into the air as the spinning silver blades bit in and the tree trunks fell into separate logs. He filmed the mobile cranes lifting the logs onto the trailer beds of the logging vehicles. He filmed the hordes of naked Uhali slaves working in the red mud to keep the roads open for the massive trucks and trailers to pass over as they bore away the looted treasures of the forest. He had hoped that the act of manipulating the camera and viewing the scene through the intervening lens might somehow isolate him from reality, might allow him to remain aloof and objective. It was a vain hope. The longer he watched the destruction, the more angry he became, until his rage matched that of the woman who sat on the branch beside him. Kelly did not have to give voice to her outrage. He could feel it like static electricity in the air around her. It did not surprise him that he was so in tune with her feelings. It seemed only right and natural. They were very close now. A new bond had been forged between them to reinforce the attraction and sympathy that they had already conceived for each other. They stayed in the treetop until nightfall, and then they remained another hour, sitting in darkness, as though they could not tear themselves away from the terrible fascination of it. They listened to the growl of engines in the night, and watched the floodlights and the swinging headlights turn the forest and the devastated red plain to daylight. It never stopped, but went on and on and on, cutting, digging, roaring, spilling out poison and death. When at last it began to rain again, and the lightning and the thunder crashed overhead, they crept down from the treetop and made their way slowly and sadly back to where Pumba waited in the forest with the porters. In the morning they started back through the steaming silent forest towards Gondala, stopping only for Daniel to film the polluted bleeding rivers. Victor Omeru went down into the muck and stood knee-deep in it and spoke into the camera, giving articulate voice to all their sorrow and rage. His voice was deep and compelling and filled with concern and compassion for his land and its people. His silver hair and dark, noble features would hold the attention of any audience, and his credentials were impeccable. His international reputation was such that nobody could seriously doubt that what he described to them was the truth. If Daniel could show this to the outside world, he knew that he would be able to communicate his own sense of outrage. They moved on slowly. The Bambuti porters were still subdued and dismayed, although they had not witnessed the mining. Seppu had described it to them, and they had seen the bleeding rivers, Yet even before they reached the boundary between the heartland and their traditional hunting grounds, they were given even greater cause for sorrow. They cut the tracks of an elephant. They all recognized the spoor of the beast, and Seppu called him by name. "The old man with one ear," he said, and they all agreed. It was the bull with half his left ear missing. They laughed for the first time in days, as though they had met an old friend in the forest. But the laughter was short-lived as they studied the spoor. Then they cried out and wrung their hands and whimpered with fear and horror. Kelly called urgently to Seppu. "What is it, old friend?"
"Blood," Seppu answered her. "Blood and urine from the elephant. He is wounded. He is dying."
"How has this happened?" Kelly cried. She also knew the elephant like an old friend. She had come across him often in the forest when he had frequented the area around Gondala.
"A man has struck and wounded him. Somebody is hunting the bull in the sacred heartland. It is against all law and custom. Look! Here are the tracks of the man's feet lying over the spoor of the bull."
He pointed out the clear imprints of small bare feet in the mud.
"Their hunter is a Bambuti. He must be a man of our clan. It is a terrible sacrilege. It is an offence against the god of the forest."
The little group of pygmies were shaken and horrified. They clustered together like lost children, holding each other's hands for comfort in these dreadful days when all they believed in was being turned upside down. First the machines in the forest and the bleeding rivers, and now this sacrilege committed by one of their own people.
"I know this man," Pamba shrieked. "I recognize the mark of his feet. This man is Piri."
They wailed then and covered their faces, for Piri had made his kill in the sacred places, and the shame and the retribution of the forest god must come down upon all of them.